The last few months, on the final Sunday of the month, I've been taking some time to go back and look at some things of the Old Covenant following a survey of the Old Testament. In doing so, we looked at what we generally refer to as the patriarchal age to begin with. We looked at the events surrounding the book of Genesis, the beginning of the world, the flood that took place in the days of Noah, and then those things that took place thereafter with the calling of Abraham, and then the famine and such that was involving the children of Jacob and the Israelites as they were beginning then going into the land of Egypt. And we talked about their Egyptian bondage, and then we talked about their exodus, and last time we talked about their coming out of the captivity and the Egyptian bondage that they had been associated with for some 430 years or so. And the events, we looked quickly at the events that took place in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. We didn't look very closely at the book of Deuteronomy, but the book of Deuteronomy is a summary of all the things that have happened to the Israelites from the time they left the land of Egypt through the end of the life of Moses, because Moses recounts all those things in the book of Deuteronomy. And we talked about their wilderness wanderings and their time at Mount Sinai and the building of the tabernacle and those sort of things that took place, the giving of the law. And as we came to the close of those books, we considered the beginnings of their move toward the land of Canaan. You look in those books and you find the story of how they came up to the southern border of the land of Canaan, and they sent spies into the land, and those spies came back and gave a report. There were two names that stood out as you look at that particular account, and that are the names of Joshua and Caleb. And certainly they stand out because, as we've looked at that in more detail in the past, they were the ones who came back with a good report of the land of Canaan. They said, "We can take it." But the rest of the nation turned away, and because of their unbelief, they were doomed to wander in the wilderness and lose their lives over the course of about 40 years. That brings us to what is taking place in the book of Joshua. Some 40 years later, we find Moses being told by God that he's going to die, and he goes and he dies up on the mountain, and Joshua is given the charge of the nation of Israel. And they were told that they were supposed to take the land of Canaan. Joshua was given assurance by God that he was going to receive the same kind of benefit that Moses had had. God would be with him. God would guide him. God would direct him and help him in leading the children of Israel into the land of Canaan. And he gave a charge to Joshua. In the first part of the book of Joshua, in chapter 1 in particular, we want to look at verse 6 and 7. He says, "Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go." Several times in this charge, God gives Joshua the charge to be strong and courageous. And we find that in several places in the book of Joshua as well. But the story of Joshua begins certainly with the conquest of Canaan, but their beginning is very similar to the beginning of the nation that we looked at when we talked about Leviticus and Numbers and the book of Exodus as well. Because the first thing they had to do after they crossed the River Jordan and were in the land that God had given them is they observed the Passover feast. And all of Israel had to be circumcised once again. Mention is made of these things in regard because while they were wandering in the wilderness, those who had been circumcised after they crossed the Red Sea, came to Mount Sinai, they died because of their unbelief in the wilderness. Those who had grown up as they wandered in the wilderness were not circumcised. They were not set apart as God's people. And so we see as the book of Joshua begins and starts telling that story, that they began with observing the Feast of the Passover, and circumcising all of the males of the nation of Israel. And as we have looked at the Battle of Jericho and some of the things that took place at that time, we noted at that time they were in sight of their enemies when they did this, which demonstrates God's protection of them. Before they took the city of Jericho, though, they sent spies into the land, into the city, and they spied out the land. And there was one person that stood out in the story about Jericho and the beginning of conquering the land of Canaan, and that is the woman Rahab. And as we have mentioned several names as we have gone through that would be good for us to keep in mind, Adam and Seth, Noah and Shem, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. And as we looked last time, we added the name Moses. Now we might add the name Joshua as one of the important figures to help us keep in mind the things that happened. But we might also want to add the name Rahab, because the name Rahab comes back into our purview and into our consideration even in the New Testament, because when you turn to Matthew chapter 1 and you read the genealogy of Christ, there's a Rahab mentioned there, who is the father, or the mother of Boaz. We'll talk a little more about Boaz later on in the lesson if we get that far, but I want you to take note that most likely that is this Rahab. There's no other reason to mention her in a specific manner such as this, but Rahab, who saved the spies, is in that lineage of Jesus leading up to King David. She's the mother of Boaz, evidently. But certainly we know the story of Jericho and the things that took place there. They went in, they surrounded the city, they walked around it one time each day for 6 days, and then on the seventh day they walked around it 7 times, only the priest making any noise whatsoever. On that seventh day, after the trumpet sounded and at the command of Joshua, all of Israel shouted after the seventh round of the city, and the walls fell down. And out of all the things of that city, there was only one family that was saved, and that was the family of Rahab, because she submitted to the instructions that she received from the spies when they made the agreement. She and her family were in her house on the wall. They were protected by God because of her faith in God. And certainly part of what we see in that story about Jericho is that the people of the land of Canaan saw the power of God and became afraid. But another thing associated with that story of the taking of the city of Jericho is the story of sin in the camp. The story of failure in the nation of Israel. They're defeated by the small city Ai. And certainly we understand, we know why. We've read from the book of Joshua, and it was because of sin. But I want us to take note as we consider this, as we're going through a survey, so we won't spend a lot of time on this or any one point, but I think it's important for us to note they suffered the consequences of sin that they did not even know was there. God punished Israel because there was sin among them, even though the leaders of Israel and much of the nation had no idea that there was sin. Why? Because the sin separated them from God. They were held accountable. Certainly we know the story. They were defeated by Ai. Joshua and the leaders of Israel came before God. They discovered that there was sin. They took the steps that God instructed them to take care of that sin. They stoned Achan and all of his family. And then they were able to go and defeat Ai, following the plan and desire of God in regard to that. Next in the story of Joshua, we might remember the story of the Gibeonites. And here again is a mistake in Israel that stands out and that we can learn from. And I'm certain we've heard lessons from this, or at least in regards to this, sometimes about being careful of not including God in our plans, because the Gibeonites came to Joshua and the Israelites and said, "We came from a long ways away and we want to be your friends. We want to have an alliance with you." But they were from just a short ways away. They were one of the peoples that Israel was supposed to destroy. They deceived Israel by the way they presented themselves, and because Israel did not consult with God regarding accepting these people, they had a thorn in their flesh for the remainder of their time here on earth. It was just the beginning of their time in Canaan with the thorns and such that they had to do. Certainly we recognize the first part of the book of Joshua talks about the conquest that he did, the conquest of the northern part of Palestine, the conquest of the southern part of Palestine, and some of the areas and particular cities that they took, the kings that they defeated. And it does us good to go through and read some of those things from time to time. But we get about to the middle of the book in Joshua chapter 14. And there's an event there that I want us to take notice of because it makes reference back to that man Caleb who was faithful to God. And it's also one of those places that gives us some time frame in regards to the land or the nation of Israel. When we read from the request that Joshua received from Caleb, when Caleb come up to Joshua as they were starting to divide the territories out, Caleb makes mention that he was, in verse 7 of Joshua chapter 14, I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought word back to him as it was in my heart. Now, if we go on down to verse 10, he says, now behold, the Lord has let me live, just as he spoke, these 45 years. By looking at this statement of Caleb, we can see confirmation that the Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. They spent 40 years wandering, and about 5 years had been taking place in conquering the peoples of the land up to this point. So Caleb had gone from being a 40-year-old man to being an 85-year-old man. And of course, he says, I'm as strong now as I was then. Let me have my mountain. And there's a whole lesson in the courage and faithfulness and trust of Caleb. But this is one of the places where we can get some verification regarding the time frame of the things that happened. Everyone who was there on the southern border of the land of Canaan, except for Joshua and Caleb, were now dead, who were of age. And it was their children that were coming to take over the land and to receive the inheritance. And certainly in chapter 14, we see the beginning of the dividing of the land. One of the things that stands out, Judah had the southern part of the land. The sons of Joseph had the northern end of the land. The rest of the tribes were scattered between. Certainly we know the 2.5 tribes were on the eastern side of the Jordan. But the rest of the tribes were given the land between Joseph's children, Ephraim and Manasseh, half tribe of Manasseh, and Judah. And if you look at a map, you can see that there were large portions given to Judah, to Manasseh and Ephraim. Some of the others moved on to the outside because they didn't have as much land as they wanted, and they moved to other areas. Joshua said, move on up there and take it. It's yours for the taking. God will be with you. This map gives a good approximation of the divisions of the land. If you take the time to sit down and read beginning in chapter 15 and on through, you can follow the cities on the map as to where the particular nations, particular tribes were given their inheritance. This was all given out at the instruction of God because this is the land that God had promised to them. One thing that stands out in the dividing of this land, and it's made mention of couple of times, the Levites didn't inherit any land. They didn't have a place that was their tribe. If you could see this map closer up, you'd find there's no Levitical priest area whatsoever. Their inheritance was the sacrifices and the tabernacle and the service of the Lord, because they had stood with Moses when Aaron and the rest of the people had gone after and worshipped the golden calf. They were the ones that came to Moses and said, yes, we will stand with you and with God at Mount Sinai. They were scattered throughout the nation of Israel. They were given 48 cities. Those cities are enumerated in chapter 21 of the book of Joshua. And there were also 6 cities that were given as cities of refuge, places where one who had shed innocent blood, one who had killed someone without meaning to, by accident, could go there and be saved from the wrath of the one who was kin to that who had been killed. There are two things elsewhere found in Joshua chapter 21 toward the end of Joshua chapter 21 and verse 43. We read a statement there that is important to us today and was important to the Jews in the days of Christ as well. It's something that we should hold into our minds because we're faced from time to time with things that this particular statement will deal with, can solve. The Lord gave Israel all the land which He had sworn to give to their fathers, and they possessed it and lived in it. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, according to all that He had sworn to their fathers, and no one of all their enemies stood before them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hand. Not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. They all came to pass. Joshua chapter 21 and verse 45 is a very important verse of affirmation that God fulfilled His promises regarding the land that He had made to Abraham, that He had made to Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt, when they were at Mount Sinai. They were given all the things God promised them in the days of Joshua. They received it. And then in Joshua chapter 23 beginning in verse 6, in what is titled, maybe if your Bible has headings in it, is headed Joshua's Farewell Address, beginning in verse 6 of Joshua chapter 23. Be very firm then to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, so that you may not turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left, so that you will not associate with these nations, these which remain among you, or mention the name of their gods, or make anyone swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them. But you are to cling to the Lord your God, as you have done to this day. Joshua gave to Israel the same charge that God had given to him. Keep God's law. He makes mention of some of the nations that were still among them. If you go and read through the chapters that talk about the giving of the land to Judah and to Ephraim and Manasseh in particular, you'll find statements made toward the end of that giving of the land that there was this particular people that they didn't drive out and it caused them trouble all of their days. In fact, that happened with all of them. Various tribes, they had some that they didn't drive out. And it caused them difficulties and troubles all of their time in the land of Canaan. It was one of the reasons that they kept failing to serve God and having to be brought back. Of course, as we come to the close of the book of Joshua, at the end in chapter 4, we recognize and see that Joshua passes away. He is buried there. There's also mention made of the bones of Joseph being buried in the land of Canaan. Remember, he'd made the Israelites promise to carry his bones out with them so that when they came to the land of Canaan, he could be buried in that land. And then we come to the book of Judges. And we find in the book of Judges a little bit of a repeat of some of the things, because we see here again some mention made regarding some of the things that are said and some of the places that had not been conquered, not been overcome, because the Israelites did not drive out all of the inhabitants of the land. We see another reporting of the death of Joshua. There's also a battle for the city of Jerusalem as we come into the book of Judges. But for the main part, what we find in the book of Judges is the story of Israel's continual failures and having to be brought back. In fact, in the first part of the book of Judges, in chapter 1 and chapter 2, when you read through there, you see rather quickly, it's almost a summary of what you're going to see in looking at the entire book. Israel served the Lord as long as somebody was alive who believed the Lord and would lead them. Then they turned away from God. Things started getting real bad, and they would cry out to God, and God would send them a deliverer, and that deliverer would come and call them out. And as long as he was leading them, or someone who remembered him was in charge, they served the Lord, and then they got away from him. If you take note of our timeline that we have up here, the period of Judges lasts for a little over 300 years. And it includes several things. First, it includes all of the things that we read in the book of Judges. It also includes the story of Ruth and Naomi, and the first eight chapters of the book of 1 Samuel would fall into this timeline of the judges, because this is the time period in which there were many who were raised up by God to lead Israel as Israel tried to serve Him yet failed and turned away. And as we'll make note, when we get over in the first part of the book of Samuel, we consider some of the things that are talked about there. God was to be the king over Israel. He was to be their ruler. He was to reign supreme in their hearts and in their minds. But they kept falling to the nations that they allowed to live in them, live among them. They kept turning away from God. They turned away to idolatry, and they were brought into servitude by various nations throughout the land where they lived. In verse 9 of Judges chapter 3, we read, "When the sons of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the sons of Israel to deliver them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, was raised by the Lord, given the Spirit of the Lord, we told, so that he could overthrow." We read in verse 11 that the land had rest for 40 years. Just about long enough for Othniel to run his course, pass away. And then they again began to do evil in the sight of the Lord. Eglon, king of Moab, stood against Israel. And in chapter 3 and verse 15, we read that God raised up Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, a left-handed man. He delivered them from the king of Moab. And Israel had rest for a short period of time. In fact, it says the land in verse 30 was undisturbed for 80 years. And then in verse 31, after him came Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He also saved Israel. Then again, the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And God raised up Deborah. And the story of Deborah and Barak is found in chapters 4, their song in chapter 5, their victory over those who had oppressed them, those who had caused them problems because Israel turned away from God. And then they're oppressed by the Midianites. And to overthrow the Midianites, God raised up a fellow named Gideon. We know Gideon. He's the guy that had the 300 men that stood with lights and trumpets and defeated the Midianites by breaking the trumpets, by breaking the lamps around the lights, the pitchers around the lamps, I should say, and blowing on the trumpets, and scaring them to death, basically, is what it boils down to. Certainly, when we read that story, we recognize it is the hand of God involved. There's a story of how Gideon was called, his initial lack of faith or trust, and the assurance that God gave him. And then Gideon saved them from the Midianites. Verse 28 of chapter 8, we read, "Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads anymore, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon." And there was more trouble that came along. We have the conspiracy of Abimelech in chapter 9. I might make note, we're talking about the various judges through here. If you look at some records, some places that are talking about judges, they don't include Abimelech. And if you read what happens here, you might understand that maybe he's not necessarily one of the judges, but oftentimes he's included as one of the 15 judges over the nation of Israel. And we have his story there in chapter 9. Then after Abimelech died, we're told in chapter 10 and verse 1 that Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar, rose to save Israel. We've looked at several of these and talked about several of these, and I know you can't read all that, but if you can see those white boxes on there, each one of those white boxes is where one of the judges was. And see how they're scattered throughout the nation of Israel. And much of what we recognize when we read these various stories and the things that are taking place, they happened in a particular region of Israel, maybe more so than over all of Israel itself. And that's an important thing for us to know. Sometimes we read through here and we think, well, Tola, he was in charge and he judged over all of Israel. But his influence may have just been in the particular area where he was there, just below where it says West Manasseh, just across from where it says Mediterranean Sea there. Some of the others as well. After him, Jair, the Gileadite, judged Israel for 22 years. Then we have the story of Jephthah. The story of Jephthah was made famous just a few decades ago now instead of a few years ago because of the vow that he made. You remember the vow that Jephthah made? He vowed to God that if he would help him, if God would help him to overcome their oppressors, that he would offer to God the first thing that came to him when he came home. When he came home, he looked up and was sorrowful, saw that it was his daughter who came to greet him first. A rash vow, but a vow that he fulfilled because of the promise he had made to God. He kept that vow, even though it was a rash vow. We read in chapter 12 of Jephthah and his successors, and then in verse 8 of chapter 12, we read of Ibzan of Bethlehem judging Israel after him. Then Elon, the Zebulonite, judged Israel after him for 10 years. And in verse 13, Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Perathonite, judged Israel after him. And then the Philistines come and oppress. And we have another one of those judges that stands out to us. Samson. The story of Samson begins in chapter 13. And continues in chapter 14, chapter 15, chapter 16. The story of Samson and how he judged Israel by defeating the Philistines. Much of what we see Samson doing is not something that we would encourage our own sons or daughters to do. But he was appointed by God to relieve Israel of the oppression of the Philistines. Now, they weren't completely defeated, because we find the Philistines still being a thorn in the side of the nation of Israel in the days of David. But Samson did bring revenge upon them, and we know the story of Samson and Delilah and of the riddles that he told and how she tricked him and how she told others about what he was saying and how eventually she convinced him to tell her what his strength was, and that was in his hair. They cut his hair and the Philistines took him over. Those of us who have children have probably told this story 1,000 times over the course of the years, those that teach Bible classes and such, because it's a story that stands out. Samson is well thought of when you talk about a judge of Israel. Probably Deborah, Gideon, and Samson stand out above all the others as ones that people know. But there are 15 men and women who judged Israel. 13 of them mentioned, particularly in the book of Judges. Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, Abimelech, Tola, Jair, Jephthah, Ibzan, Elon, Abdon, and Samson. And yes, I do have those typed out on the screen so I don't forget one of them. One time I had them all memorized, but I miss one every now and then. After Samson, we have some other stories that take place in the nation of Israel that show some of the wickedness that was going on. In chapter 17, we have the story of Micah's idolatry and how he convinced a Levite to be a priest for him and his particular household to his idols. The Danites taking his idols and taking his priest away from him. Then in chapter 19, we have the story of the Levite and his concubine who was abused and then was sent throughout the nation as a demonstration of what was going on. This led to the destruction, almost complete destruction, of one of the tribes. The Benjaminites were defeated by the Israelites because of what had happened. Almost completely destroyed. In fact, the decision was made that none in Israel would marry any of the women of Benjamin. And then, of course, the latter part of the last chapter of the book of Judges tells us that they had to make some provisions so that the tribe of Benjamin would continue. The book of Judges is a book that is full of the wishy-washiness of the nation of Israel. Of the everything is great as long as somebody's watching over us and keeping us out of trouble. But as soon as their back is turned, as soon as they're no longer watching, we forget that God is there and we turn off to our own designs and our own desires. There's a lesson there for us. We need to know that God is always watching us. God is our king. We need to be careful that we don't find ourselves following the pattern of the nation of Israel. We keep in mind God is ruler supreme over us today, as he should have been in the eyes of the Israelites and even in the days of the judges. Then we have the story of Ruth. It comes immediately after the book of Judges. It is a story that takes place during the time of the judges. And here is another woman whose name needs to be made mention of, that we need to consider and we need to remember. Because Ruth married Boaz, and that led to the birth of David. Now, he'll be more important in a later survey. We're not going to get into the kingdoms this evening. But all I want you to take note that in the genealogy that is found in Matthew chapter 1 and in the genealogy that is found in Luke chapter 3, Rahab and Ruth are part of that genealogy. They are ancestors of David. David, the man after God's own heart. They play an important role in the story of salvation throughout the Scripture, and they are made mention of again specifically in Matthew chapter 1. The story of Ruth is a story of devotion, a story of love, a story of God's preservation. And certainly we've spent an entire lesson looking at what takes place in that story. It's a story not just of Ruth, but of her mother-in-law, Naomi. There's much that can be learned by studying that book, but the main thing we want to notice this evening, not just that Ruth was a part of the genealogy of Christ, but this story takes place in the midst of all the things that are happening in the book of Judges. I don't know exactly which judge time it falls in. I don't know that there's any way to determine. But it's during that good and bad period of the nation of Israel. And it shows that those who devoted themselves to God and served God were still watched over by God, even in the midst of all the turmoil of the nation. And we come to Samuel. We include the first eight verses, or first eight chapters of the book of Samuel in this because it talks about two more judges, Eli and Samuel. Eli was a judge over the nation of Israel. He was the one that watched over, but there was another whose story begins in this book. And it begins with his mother and her desire to have a child. We know the story of Hannah. They came to Jerusalem as they were supposed to on a regular basis. And Hannah prayed to God, seeking that God would give her a child. And she promised God that if he would give her a son, she would give him to God. And that's exactly what happened. She received the son Samuel, and as soon as he was weaned, she sent him to serve Eli, who was the high priest at that time. He was in charge of the nation of Israel. Samuel was trained by Eli. You remember the story of how Samuel and Eli were asleep, and Samuel heard God calling for him, not knowing who he was or what was going on. He went to Eli and said, "What do you want?" And now God called him again. He went to Eli and said, "What do you want?" And Eli figured out what was going on, and he said, "Samuel, answer the Lord when he calls." Certainly, the message that Samuel receives is a message that is not pleasant for him to hear because his master is going to lose his life and lose his sons. But it's because of the wickedness of Eli and of his sons. And of course, we know the story how Eli convinced Samuel to tell him what the Lord had said. No matter what it wasn't Samuel's fault. It was what God was going to have take place. This is also where we read the story of the Ark of the Covenant being taken. In fact, it is at the notification that the Ark of the Covenant has been taken that Eli falls off his chair and breaks his neck. His sons died in the same battle. Samuel is left to judge the nation of Israel, but Israel has rejected him. And they say, give us a king. And we know how Samuel was upset because of that, that they were turning away from God. God told him, he has not rejected you, they've rejected me. When we look back over what we have considered and talked about, we've seen 2,700 years in the patriarchal age, and we've seen the beginning of 1,400 years in the Mosaic age. We've gone from about 4,200 B.C. to 1095 B.C. Some 4,000 years. And the continuing story in all of that has been salvation for God's people through His plan. As we pointed out this morning when we were talking about our lesson in the book of Hebrews, it's been God's plan from the very beginning to save man through Jesus. And what we have seen thus far is the preparation of the people who would bring Jesus into the world. We've seen the men who have led Israel and how many of them have been successful in leading Israel, but many were failures. And how when Israel had a leader who passed away, they turned back away from God because they would not submit themselves to God unless somebody was constantly watching. Evil crept in because they allowed sin in the camp. They were defeated because they allowed sin in the camp. Constantly beset by the nations that they allowed to continue to live with them because they let sin in their midst. Maybe that's one of the lessons we can glean from looking at the story of Israel overall. If we want to be right in the sight of God, we've got to get rid of the things of this world. We've got to cleanse ourselves of the wickedness and of the sin that's around us. Separate ourselves. Israel was supposed to be a separate nation, special unto God. We got to allow Him to reign in our lives. Maybe some of this is just a review for you, just a reminder, but I hope it does help us keep some things in context, keep some things in order, and I hope that it's some help as we go through looking at the book of Hebrews. If I were a real organized person, I would say I'd plan it so that it would end up right as we started Hebrews, but I'm not an organized person. I plan to do these at the end of every month, but it just worked out that we started Hebrews this morning. I hope they're a benefit to us. More importantly, I hope we take the time to read and study from the Word of God, even the Old Testament. Learn the lessons that it teaches us about devotion to the Lord, dedication to His cause. And that when each of us looks at our own life and we find things that are amiss, we correct them. And we go to God and ask Him to forgive so that we might be right in His sight and we might keep sin out of our lives so that we can enter into heaven and be with Him when this life is over. If you look this evening and find there's things in your life that are amiss, we urge you to correct them. Pray to God and ask Him to forgive. You don't have to offer sacrifices like Israel had to. Just pray, confess your sins to God and ask Him to forgive. If you've committed something publicly, correct it publicly, certainly. But seek forgiveness from God as well. If we can assist you in that, opportunity is yours. Come on, we stand and sing.